Petition number 9708, Reel 3.
Savannah Lovell, Reel 3.
Yes, Schomburg had reconstituted the MI team after after we'd killed in the Halifax his great men, Blumlein, Brown and Blyden, and we had help from our own production unit in TRE. And by the end of that year, 1942, we had fitted 24 Halifax and 24 Sterling heavy bombers. And Bennett had now had control of these in the Pathfinder force, and he intended to use them for marking the target by flares. And we were still very unhappy with the way the equipment was performing, and we wondered whether anybody but a trained scientist would ever be able to use it. And I quote my own diary here, which I kept at that time. I wrote that it amazed us that so much of the country's effort was being taken up to make these equipments when the only ones flying were terribly bad and almost unusable. And our anxieties in the autumn of 1942 were exacerbated by messages from D.M. Robinson, who was one of our expatriates in America, in which he stated that H2S simply did not work in America. And then I.I. Raabe, the very, very distinguished American physicist who you may have seen associated with the atomic bomb development, was sent over by Roosevelt to plead with D.M. and myself not to risk using the magnetron over enemy territory, because we knew that once we lost a bomber over enemy territory, the Germans would get the secret of the magnetron, and we, the Americans, and so it was very serious. Well, the fact is that the Americans were wrong over the fact that it didn't work. It worked in this country, and it was simply a matter of refining the polar diagram before we got excellent. And Killip, who was our navigator, he eventually became very enthusiastic about it. He did trials of the bomber development unit and reported that it was valuable to a high extent, both as a navigational aid and as an aid to locating targets. And Bennett, of course, was tremendously enthusiastic about it. He was exerting immense pressure for his squadrons. And he had, by December the 31st, 1942, of the Halifaxes and Stirlings we'd fitted, he had 12 Halifaxes in 35 squadron at Gravely, and 12 Stirlings of 7 squadron at Oakington, and they were all equipped with H2S. Which is astonishing, isn't it? In what I said in that year, I mean, only a few months after we'd crashed the only equipment we had. Well, the Russians held the line of the Volga and held Stalingrad, as you know, and the air staff at last gave authority for H2S to be used operationally. On January the 29th, a Friday evening, 1943, I had telephone calls from O'Kane, a member of my staff who was at Bennett's HQ, who said it would be a good idea for me to take the weekend in the country. And I had a message from Bomber Command on Saturday morning to get to Witten, near Huntington, urgently. And I was in the mess by 5:30 in the evening in time to be there at the briefing for the H2S raid, which was to be on Berlin, but the weather was so bad that it was diverted to Hamburg. And what a night that was, that Saturday night. I mean, the weather conditions were appalling, and 40 Lancasters of the main bomber force could turn back. But and so 4 of our H2S aircraft, because their sets had gone out of action. But at last, I remember so well as dawn was breaking, we had the navigators of the Halifaxes and Stirlings who had made the raid, and they came back terribly excited. They had been able to see on their cathode ray tube all the docks and everything, just drop their bombs bang on. Well, that was okay, but Bennett then sent us a signal to say that H2S is the most successful blind navigation and bombing aid yet devised, and congratulations. Well, no, it was HQ Bomber Command. Congratulations, Ben, and all that. But of course, it wasn't the end of our problems. People still began to worry. They used to argue that it was not good enough, and inevitably, one of our bombers was lost near Rotterdam. We thought that the Germans could not fail to acquire the secret of that magnetron of H2S. I would like to just break off my story here to tell you, to put on record, a remarkable circumstance. That bomber was shot down near Rotterdam in February of 1943 in one of the early raids. At the end of the war, just after I'd returned to the university, I was summoned back to TRE, we were in Morven, to see Portal, the chief of air staff, who had a captured German equipment. And this damned German equipment was almost an exact copy of ours, of that vintage, but it didn't work. Now, on the 19th of April, 1977, we're talking about now, that's what, 30-odd years later, I was on a liaison visit to people who'd become our German colleagues and who'd built a large radio telescope like the one I'm looking at now at Effelsberg. I dined one evening with the director, who was Professor Hackenberg. And I was rather embarrassed because he asked me what I'd been doing during the war. You know, the circumstances had changed so that one freely talked about it. Although we were enemies then, it was interesting to know what one another had done. I was rather embarrassed, I told him, because I'm afraid my device had caused a lot of destruction in Germany. And I said, what did he do in those years? And he replied that he was also a young man working on radar. And one day in February 1943, and I'm quoting from a note I wrote at that time, I'm quoting Hagenberg, one day in February 1943, he was sent to investigate the equipment in a bomber which had been shot down near Rotterdam. It was your H2S, he said to me. Wasn't that remarkable? Then I said, was he surprised to discover the secret of the magnetron? No, he was not, because they'd already made a similar device. But they could not discover how our H2 system worked. And I was mystified by this, because I thought the only mystery about our equipment was a magnetron. And he said there was a broken glass tube which completely mystified us. Now, suddenly dawned on me that this broken glass tube was a spark gap filled with argon at very low pressure, which protected the receiver during the transmitted pulse. And they couldn't unravel this. They couldn't make a common TR system. And therefore, they were completely mystified as to how our H2S worked. And that was revealed to me in 1977. By the spring of 43, the production of line of H2S for the main bomber force had commenced, and so we no longer depended on the small number which had been produced by ourselves and by EMI on what we called then a crash program for the Pathfinder force. I will go back to some other events that happened in 1943 in a moment. I better finish the story of H2S. That equipment worked on 9 centimeters, 10 centimeters, and in August of 1943, Bomber Command became under intense pressure to mount attacks on Berlin, and they staged two major attacks, and the result was a disaster to the bomber force. On the 23rd of August, they lost 57 out of 719 heavy bombers. And on the 31st of August, they lost 47 out of 612 heavy bombers. Now, even if those attacks had been successful, they couldn't support losses at that rate. The raids were not successful. And people blame the inaccuracy of H2S. Now, Dudley Sayward, shortly after that, he came in despair to see me. He often did. He came every other day from High Wycombe, DRE. And he showed me the pictures of the cathode ray tube that had been taken by an aircraft near Berlin. And I could see that H2S was useless. I don't think it was necessary to blame it for the inaccuracy of the rate, but I could see that it was useless. The entire 10-mile circle of our cathode ray tube was covered with blurred responses, you see. And there was absolutely nothing on which the navigator could make a fix. They then say it would produce the map of Berlin, and if you look at a map of Berlin, once on any large scale map of Germany, you're immediately possessed by these large numbers of lakes throughout the city. And I had an enormous map on the wall of my office, actually. There's no need for a Sayward shirt. So I said to Sayward, but it's perfectly simple. I said, if you really want to get a good fix on Berlin, you'll give us some people and ask us to equip a few aircraft with the 3-centimeter version of this H2S instead of the 10-centimeter, because we had been testing a 3-centimeter version. Well, within 2 weeks, Sayward said we'd made the craziest plans possible to equip 6 Lancasters with 3-centimeter H2S. We'd already been testing it in a Stirling aircraft at Defford, but we weren't very happy with the performance. I've got a photograph somewhere of the progress sheet on the wall of my office, and we produced these with the help of a big group of Air Force people, technicians that Sayward sent us. We produced these aircraft with them. We equipped them ourselves at Defford. First of all, Sayward sent us 3 Lancasters, and by the 13th of November, Sayward only came to me in August, by the 13th of November we had delivered 3 of these aircraft to the Pathfinder Force. And 4 days later, we sent Bennett another 3. On the 22nd of November, Bennett used these 6 aircraft to mark the targets on Berlin. And they were the most devastating attacks ever made. I mean, he could pinpoint the Tempelhof aerodrome. I've got the pictures in here. It's quite remarkable. And Leipzig, and then Hamburg. I mean, the great firestorm of Hamburg. All this was done by the marking of these few 3-centimeter H2S aircraft. By the end of 1943, 32,000 of the 53,000 sorties of Bomber Command were led by H2S aircraft. Well, I think really that, as far as the... Are we still running?
Yes.
Yes. That was really the apex of the H2S story. There are some other very important things that I want to put on record. But after that, as far as H2S was concerned, it became a matter of getting more and more definition and getting improved versions into the main force, stabilizing the scanners so that the picture would stay even when the aircraft took evasive action and so on. And by the time of the
D-Day,
we did have a massive aircraft flying with a K-band system, what, two centimeter, 1-point-something centimeters, in which we could actually see tanks on the ground from 10 or 15,000 feet. But the Allies then made so much progress. And after D-Day, I think H2S as a bombing aid became less important for obvious reasons. I mean, the peak of the H2 effort was undoubtedly these raids on Berlin and Hamburg and Leipzig, where Bennett was able to use the 3-centimeter version, although there were smaller aircraft, to mark with very great precision. And then it gradually got into the main force and became an important navigational aid as soon as they got beyond the range of G. Oba, of course, was limited to very few aircraft anyhow. The 2 other things I want to say. On as you will realize, by the end of 43, as I've said, 32,000, you see, about 60 or 70% of all the sorties of Bomber Command were led by HOS aircraft, and it was in the main force. And large numbers of the heavy bombers making attacks over Germany were equipped with our H2S equipment. Story got around at this time that H2S bombers, the bombers with H2S were being singled out for attack and destroyed by enemy fighters. You'll find this myth perpetrated in R.V. Jones's book, Most Secret War. You know absolutely nothing about it, and he's got the story entirely wrong. Well, our bombers did carry a tail warning device. Now, I want to tell you the most amazing story here. Hodgkin, a colleague I've mentioned during the war, he had been developed an AGLT, that is an air gun lane turret, using sentiment before, but that was far away from being used. And Sabre came to me with a depressing story that we suddenly began to suffer very severe losses in our bomber force. And incidentally, it was nothing to do with the German fighters homing onto the H2S aircraft. What had happened is that there'd been a sudden change in the night fighter tactics, in that they'd been attacking the bombers from below and thereby avoiding the rather crude tail warning device which was in the bombers. And Sabre came to me on the 18th of April 43 in a state of some considerable anxiety about this, and he said, could we do anything about it, or what did I think? And must have been a rather nice evening in the spring, because we walked up to the Worcester Beacon. It's a favourite walk for people, young people who lived in Malvern in those days. I don't know if you know Malvern, these no. lovely Worcestershire hills. Well, the Worcestershire Beacon overlooks the city of Malvern, and you're sent about 1,000 feet or what, for 1,200 feet or something like that. It's quite an easy walk. And he said to me quite casually that there was a marvellous view to the east, and he'd understood there was no high ground between where we were and the Urals. You see, and I suddenly saw the solution when he made that remark to the problem of saving the bombers. Because I realised that there'd always be 15,000 feet of empty space before any H2S echoes could be got from the ground. So I said to Sabre, look here, send me one mechanic tomorrow. We'll build you a special display unit, and every rear gunner will be able to see a fighter coming towards them. All that we had to do was to expand the useless centre region of our time base, which was of no use for H2S. We were only interested in the ground returns, but we could easily expand that onto a separate tube. I think within a few days we tried out the idea in flight at Defford. Had arranged a mock attack by one of our fighters, and there's a picture in here again, shows this fighter very, very clearly visible in this special display. And 29th of May, that was less than a month after Sabre presented me with this terrible problem, Rennick summoned a meeting, and in which he ordered the production people to make thousands of this indicator unit, Type 182. The code name was Fish Pond. By November of that year, a half of the H2S sorties used this device, and it must have saved hundreds and hundreds of the bombers. Very, very simple device. You see, it's very interesting. The scientists in the war, I mean, as a young man, all my colleagues, we were no better than our equivalents in Germany. I mean, why were we successful and they weren't? The answer is perfectly simple. Because we had the operational people. We were constantly with them. See, I'll tell you, I'm going to put on tape another story in a moment which illustrates this about the U-boats. But we were with them constantly, and this was a natural after dinner walk and conversation with an operational chap, a man from Bomber Command, immediately revealed the solution to this problem. We must have saved thousands of lives by this expanding, putting on a special tube to the rear gunner. And
you mean it was something to do with social flexibility in England?
Social flexibility, a policy, I think, of close getting together with the people who were really flying over Germany and understanding their needs and their requirements. And we were always on their aerodromes, and there had always been a policy to keep us out of uniform so that we could say boo to the chief of air staff if it was necessary to do so. And that sort of thing didn't happen in Germany. I can explain this by saying what I really like to remember about my efforts, because, you know, in later life, I sometimes try to forget all that. It's very odd. You make a device, you see. I mean, fish bomb was fine to save lives. You make a device like H2S. Well, maybe somebody else would have made it if I really had said no. But it must have been responsible. It was responsible for the great firestorms in Hamburg. And you read about those now. It must have been terrible. You know, one has made this device which put the bombs in the right place. However, this is a retrospective judgment. In those days, you know, one's friends had been killed, one was being shot at, one was being bombed. Absolutely no holds barred at all. Whatever one's views might have been at the beginning of the war, they jolly soon changed when London was destroyed. And I used to wake up on the south coast and there were machine gun bullets rattling against the wall of the house I was in. All our work, you know, place being bombed, diving into the slit trenches the whole time. I mean, that sort of thing soon destroys any philosophical views about not wanting to deal with destructive machines. Nevertheless, in one's 70s, one becomes a little worried about all the lives, all the people one's killed. Therefore, I'd like to place on tape another side to this story. And that was our conversion of a few of these H2S equipments for coastal command to tackle the U-boats. Now, it is true that a special centimeter ASV development was in progress in TRE, but this was a very long-term thing. You know, they didn't have the equipment. They were going to be years over it. And I heard about the... I've forgotten. I don't know who it was. You read in the papers about the shipping losses, and we had means of getting the numbers, thousands of tons that the U-boats were sinking. And then we learned that the cabinet and the air staff were very worried that in 1943, when the U-boat season arrived in the spring and summer, the merchant shipping losses really might reach unacceptable proportions. The trouble was that the only locating device which the Coastal Command aircraft had was a 1.5 meter ASV equipment. It was a development of the old AI, which I talked about when in working at Schoon Airport, and I'd fitted some of this 1.5 meter ASV in the Hudson's when we were in St. Anton. Well, this was reasonably good. It could detect a U-boat, but the Germans had developed a listening device, you see, and when they captured France, they built their U-boat pens on the west coast, and they used the Bay of Biscay as a transit area. They used to surface at night to recharge their batteries and keep submerged in the daytime. So at night, when they were on the surface, they could be detected by the 1.5 meter AI, but they had these. As soon as they listened in to the pulses from the radar, they would dive, and by the time our aircraft got there, there was no target. Well, our own view, the view of myself and one or two other members of my group, was very simple: that if we were allowed to put a few of our 10-centimeter equipments, the submarines would be caught unprepared. They wouldn't hear the transmissions. We did this against immense opposition from Bomber Command, and in fact, it was one or two members of my own group, myself, who went to Chivener with the full collaboration of Slessor, who was a CNC Coast Command, man whom I had very great admiration. And we fitted up one or two of at Chivna, a really clandestine operation with Wellington aircraft. They had what is called a Lee Light, and we had collaboration with Wing Commander Lee. The idea was that you would home onto the radar echo and then switch on the Lee Light and drop your depth charge by a visual sighting. Well, we're against the opposition of Bomber Command, we fitted up six aircraft of this squadron at Chivna. And the officer commanding at Chivna, he sarcastically remarked that he now had seven of my specialists on the station, and if he thought my equipment was going to do a damn of good, I better get him one and fly over the Bay of Biscay. So however you're going to pick up one of these small things with that gear, an extraordinary reaction. Well, of course, we weren't allowed to fly over the Bay of Biscay, but his people did, and on the 1st of March 1943, he had to fly two of our centimeter-equipped ASV aircraft and our modified H2S equipment over the bay. By the end of the month, 13 submarines had been detected and attacked, and another 24 in April. U-boats were terrified. They began to surface by day and were ruthlessly attacked by the day forces of Coastal Command. You see, a few of our converted H2S equipments had absolutely transformed the strategic situation. Shipping losses were 700,000 tons in March, and by the end of August, they were down to less than 100. Churchill wrote about this, and I'm going to quote from Volume 4 of his Second World War. He says, H2S was adapted for use in the ASV role with striking advantage. In 1943, it made a definite contribution to the final defeat of the U-boats. And Hitler said at that time, quote from Hitler's remarks, "The temporary setback in our U-boat campaign is due to one single technical invention of our enemies." Extraordinary. See, now I, after all this time, I still, you'll forgive me for feeling the relief that this device, which we designed to destroy, it really saved. We would have been starved out. The shipping losses of 700,000, they would have reached a million. It would have been unsupportable. There is another lesson here. We were, on the whole, pessimistic in spite of those initial successes, because we realized that the Germans, if they'd been listening to 1.5 meter, would be a very short time before they'd also tune into our 10 centimeter one. Therefore, the previous situation would be restored. Well, we equipped 3 centimeter ASV, but all that sort of thing. Do you know they never did so? And after the war, we learnt the reason why. They didn't call in any scientists to investigate what was going on. The commanding officers or the officers of the U-boats thought that we were picking up some re-radiation from their own listening receivers. You see? And they wasted an immense amount of time on that and didn't realize that we'd changed the wavelength of our transmitters. Well, that illustrates the point I made just now, the difference. And one of a major reason for the not the difference in quality of the scientists, but the way they were used by the Allies compared with the way they were used by the Germans. After all, Wernher von Braun was put in prison at a critical time in the development of the V1 and V2. But I'm...